Welcome to the Successful Nonprofits Podcast. I'm your host, Dolph Goldenberg. And friends, today's episode is going to be a phenomenal one. We are going to be talking about incentives with Uri Ghanizi. And let me share with you, I just finished his book, Mixed Signals, How Incentives Really Work. And throughout this book, I could tell that he is a professor of behavioral economics and management at the University of California, San Diego, because I see that in every single page. And when he's talking about mixed signals, to a great extent, he's talking about the fact that sometimes, you know, we give incentives or we give off signals that are really conflicting with each other, and then people aren't really sure what to do. And this is so pertinent to us in the nonprofit sector. And that's why I really wanted to have Uri come on. I will also share with you that Uri also co-authored the book, The Y-Axis, The Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Hey, Uri, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I am so thrilled that you are here. And your book, I've got to leaf through it really quickly. It is about 300 pages of amazing information. So I know we're not going to be able to cover everything today, but there are three things I was really hoping that we could talk about. And the one I wanted to start with is you actually have a section in your book specifically for nonprofits about the overhead myth.
Yes. So my interest in it came because my wife, who is also a professor, she's a marketing professor, was interested in how to get people to care less about overhead and more about the impact that they have on society, right? So when you give money, you should care about impact. And we had this discussion, and I told her that I understand, as an economist, I understand that you should care about the impact and only this. But as a human being, I know that that's not the way I work. So imagine the following story. Imagine that you go to a conference and someone talks with you about the charity that they're running, and it's amazing. They're so convincing. You write a $1,000 check, right? You write a check for them for $1,000 and makes you really happy because you really help, say, the kids that they are supporting. Next day, you're on your flight back home. And when you go on the plane, when you go, you pass the business class, you see the CEO sitting there, zipping their champagne, while you are going to a middle seat somewhere in the back. You'll probably feel very stupid, right? Well, I gave him $1,000 to upgrade and I'm stuck in the back. That doesn't fit, right? So I understand that I shouldn't look at the overhead. I should look at the impact. But as a human being, I have this problem, right? How do you solve this conflict? And in general, you know, how do you get people to think about it? So think about my students. I talk with them about that. Imagine Jane. She goes and works for an investment bank, makes $1 million a year. I ask my students, what do you think about Jane? Awesome, she's the best. Now imagine John. He goes and works for a nonprofit, and he makes $1 million a year. Why is he stealing money from the poor? Right, and that's not the way to get the good people. We want to get the best people that also care about the cause, but we should pay them. And they shouldn't sit in a dark, small office. They should sit in a best office. And sometimes, you know, I talked with people in Belgium that were working in South Africa. You go on a flight that, I don't know, 15-hour flight, and you need to work the next day. If you're my age, I'm 56. If you do that and you arrive the next day, if you fly economy, you're dead. You're completely useless for a few days. So if that was my own business, I would have paid for their business class to fly and be functional, not because it's just nice and you get fancier food, but it's a real efficiency issue. But they don't do it because of obvious reasons. So the question that we had in our research was, how can we change this behavior towards overhead? Now, educating people, that's something important, but that takes really long time. And in some cases, even me, with the story that I gave you about the CEO in the business class, even me that I know this and I thought about this, I'll feel bad about it. You know, educating people is always good, but before that, what can you do? And what we came up with is what we call the covering the overhead, right? So imagine, and that's what we did in our experiment, we send you, an ask, and we tell you, Dolph, don't worry, all the overhead associated with this fundraising was covered by a big donor already. Turns out when we ran the experiment, turns out that this was extremely effective. People were much more likely to give money when they knew that all their money goes to the cause, right? So it's not, nothing is going to go on. Now, even when override is really needed, imagine that you're feeding kids in San Diego. You must have a truck that will take the food from the restaurant to the kids, right? There is no way to avoid this override. Even in this case, people prefer to think that they paid for the actual food that the kid ate. Why not give them this? And that's basically the idea.
So if I can just share with you, part of what I found so fascinating about that part in your book, when you ran that experiment, you actually compared it against donors getting a match. And so, you know, maybe my neighbor gets a letter that says, hey, we have a generous match. If you give $100, it will be matched by $100. And that was not as effective as the neighbor that gets the letter that says, our overhead's covered. Every dollar you give will go directly to programs.
Right, absolutely. We did the match and we did also the seed money, right? So in one, we had four groups. One of them got just asked. Another one was told, we have a donor who gave $10,000 towards the $40,000 goal that we have. That was the seed case. And then we had the one-to-one match, right? So for every dollar you'll give up to $10,000, we have someone who will match it. And the fourth group was, we got $10,000 to cover all the overhead. Now, every dollar that you'll give will go to the cause. And that was the most effective.
And I kind of feel like the takeaway for us in the nonprofit sector then is we need to be going to our closest major donors, the ones who love us the most and most willing to give just general operating support. And we also need to be going to our board and saying, hey, help us raise the money for overhead so we can go back out to everyone else and say, every dollar you give goes directly to programs.
Exactly. That's exactly the takeaway that we have, right? So don't try to educate or change the people who give $100. That's just too hard. They don't have your attention. It's not going to work. Go to the people that want to give $5 million to the new wing in the hospital and tell them, look, we can take the $5 million and do what you want, or we can use it to really cover all the overhead for the coming few years. And then we can really give this offer to the other donors that, you know, every dollar that you give will go directly towards that. And turns out that this is this could really make your contribution much more efficient. So for every dollar that you'll give, now we can raise $5, right? So we can raise much more, and that way your money goes a longer way.
I felt like that was such an important takeaway. I'll also share with you, I had a wince moment when I read this part of your book and you talked about that CEO in first class. And the reason I did is I travel an absurd amount. Like I'm on the road 100,000 miles or so a year. So I often get upgraded to first class. And it's funny because, Uri, I almost always like say to every single person, even before I get on a plane, I've never paid for first class. If I get upgraded, it's because I travel a lot. And it is funny.
I apologize.
But because I spent my life in the nonprofit sector, I just really feel a strong need to make sure people know if they ever see me there, it's not that I paid for it. You know, I earned it the hard way, butts in the seat by miles.
But you agree that it's funny that if you were a banker, you would be proud of the fact that they fly you everywhere business class, right?
So in
one case, proud of that. In the other case, you have to justify it. I didn't pay for it, right? I think that's fine. That's not the way it should be.
Right. I agree with you. But again, as you were talking about that, I had that wince moment. It's like, ooh, yeah, I fully understand as someone who often gets upgraded, like what a cognitive dissonance that would create for that $100 or $1,000 donor who walks beside you to go to their basic economy middle seat. I totally get that. I also was hoping we could talk some about incentives. And throughout the book, as you were talking about incentives, I was often thinking about ways in which incentives could be used to make our programs more effective. And there's one incentive in particular that I found fascinating, and it's the loss aversion incentive.
Right. Loss aversion is old in behavioral economics. It started with Kahneman and Tversky back in the 70s that they talked about it. And the basic idea is that losing, say, $100 is more painful in absolute way than gaining $100. Just losses are more painful than gains. And that's an old observation in the literature. And now there are some attempts to use this in incentives. So say that I ask you to finish a task, right? And in most cases, I'll tell you, Dolph, if you finish this within the coming month, I'll give you $1,000. Okay? That's the usual way. What if instead I'll tell you, here's $1,000, but sign here this contract, that if you don't finish the task by the end of the month, you'll have to pay me back the $1,000. That would be the loss frame. So it's exactly the same. In both cases, in 1 month, you're going to finish the work and get $1,000, or don't finish the work and don't have the money, right? But one of them is framed as gains, the other one is framed as losses. Turns out that the losses could be more effective, would have a stronger impact on people.
I know we all do have that sense of loss that impacts us more. And as I was trying to think about some ways maybe in the nonprofit sector that we could use this, one of the things I thought about is, I'll just throw this out as an example. Maybe if you got like a workforce development program and people are coming in for 8 or 10 sessions of training, you share with them a virtual account and you say, here's your virtual account. It has, you know, you'll get a $500 incentive when you complete our 10 session program. So here's your virtual account. For every session you miss, though, you're going to lose $75. We'll make sure that you see your balance every time you come in or every day or whatever. So then if I miss session number 3 and I see my balance go from 500 to 425, I feel like I lost something.
Yes, exactly.
I loved that as an idea around programming. What are some of the other really effective ways to incentivize the behavior we want?
Well, it's a whole book about it. One that I really like is about regret. So many of the things that we do in life are out of, you know, I don't want to regret it. It's anticipated regret, it's called. Some of it is the fear of missing out is resulting from this kind of regret, right? So if I won't go there and something good will happen, I'll regret it, right? In general, we don't like it. So the story that I like about this is my grandpa came to Israel in 1948 from Budapest after the Holocaust. And they didn't have money, but he decided to buy this state lottery that had at the time, as far as I recall, 7 numbers. And then he lived another 40 years, 40 very good years in Israel. And every week he made sure to buy the exact same numbers, right? And if he was away, he asked someone else. When I was old enough, he asked me to go and buy these numbers in a specific place that sold it there, because each ticket had a number. And the reason was that imagine that you buy it for 25 years and then you go on vacation for 2 weeks, you come back, you see that you didn't buy it this week, but the numbers came up, right? That would be horrible, right? So trying to build on this regret. So imagine I worked with a company that didn't want people to come with a car. So they offered parking, but they didn't want people to use it because it cost money. What they did, instead of just giving, you know, say $10 a day to the people, they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to put all the names of all the people who came in this, you know, hat. And some of them will have a check mark. They came without a car and some of them won't. And then say that we have 100 people. That would be $1,000, 10 times 100, that's 1,000. At the end of the day, we're going to draw one name out of this. And if we take your name, oh, Dolph, your name came up. Oh, but you came with the car. Sorry, you will not get this prize. We have to take another name. What we predicted and we found support for this is that people are really afraid of this regret that they'll have, right? Oh, I could have had $1,000 or I could have had a vacation somewhere, right? Instead of just the $10, you know, I can calculate, it's fine. But knowing that I just lost this prize is really going to be really painful. So people anticipate this regret and because of that, they're more likely to do what? So it could be more effective than simply paying them $10.
I love that experiment that you talked about in the book. And I think you also compared it to, we could give everybody $10 or we could say every day you don't drive. There was another option where it would go to a charity. But really what people liked was this opportunity to win the lottery every single day.
Yes, yes, yes. The charity. So there is something that is called the pro-social incentives. So the idea would be, say that in this case, if you don't come, we'll give some money to it. If you don't use a car, we'll give some money to a charity. Turns out, that's a work by my former student, Alex Simas. It turns out that for small amounts of money, so if I'll tell you, you know, please do this and I'll give you $1, they'll say, well, I don't care about it. Please do this and I'll give $1 to make a wish foundation. Say, well, okay, I'll do that, right? So for small amounts of money, people are more sensitive to pro-social, for donation is incentive. Turns out that when it goes bigger, so if I'll tell you $10,000, for you, that's going to have much more impact than $10,000 to a charity. So in a sense, if you think about it, your own incentives are much steeper and the way they go. So when the incentives go, the effectiveness go up very fast. pro-social is much flatter. So a dollar versus $20 will have very little difference in how much they will motivate you.
Along those lines, I also, one of my other key takeaways or things that I'll be bringing back from this book is the unintended consequences of incentives. And almost any incentive we offer probably has an unintended consequence.
Right. That's how I started actually my exploration, if you like, of incentives by looking at cases in which it doesn't work. I worked with Aldo Rustichini on a couple of things. In one case, we had people doing an IQ test. So we brought them in for half an hour. We asked them to do the IQ test. In one case, we just asked them to do that. In another case, we paid them very little for every answer. And in two other cases, we paid them more and more. And what we found was some kind of drop. If I just ask you to do something, you're going to do it. If I ask you and I tell you, I'll pay you 10 cents for it, you say, well, I can just sit and do nothing. So they're much more likely to not to do. And then when the money goes up, they're more and more likely to do. So we called it, Aldo and I called it pay enough or don't pay at all. Right? So that's on the flip side, on the negative side, we have this daycare study. In Israel, parents were supposed to pick up their kids by 4 p.m. And if you were late, wasn't clear what's going to happen, right? Until the principal in the daycare where my kids were introduced a 10 shekel, so it was $3 at the time, fine. Now, it's a very different situation. If the principal tells you, you should be there on time to pick up your kids, you should be there on time. But now there is a $3 fine. Now you say, okay, for $3, I can take a bit longer. Right? And that's what we found. So when they introduced the fine, more parents came late than without the fine. And now you can say, maybe it's because people think that they're paying for babysitting or something like that. And we claim that no, it changed the norm. It introduced some kind of information that changed the norms. Before that, you didn't know how bad it is. Now you know that it's only $3 bad. $3 is fine. And what we found is that after we removed the fine in our experiment, the daycares in which there was a fine in the middle stayed the same. So they kept coming late compared to the control, which didn't see the fine. So once you see the fine, you get the information, oh, it's not that bad. Before that, I didn't know. Now I signal to you that it's only $3 bad. And you say, okay, I can, whether I pay or not, I can still come late.
When you talked about that one, I think that's also the one where what some daycares ended up doing was saying, okay, if you're late, we'll just, you know, our director will take your child to the local police station and you can just pick your kid up from the police station, which was a pretty good incentive for people to show up on time.
Yeah, that's a story that I didn't verify, but the friend told me that happened in Paris, right? But imagine the cost in therapy that you have to pay after that.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And there are, by the way, there are other examples of this. There is a recent example from the UK. Parents want to go on vacation not during the school break, because during the school break, it's more expensive and much more crowded. So parents take their kids a week before, a week after, say, spring break, and go take them to other places. Schools didn't like it, so they introduced, if I remember correctly, £60 fine for doing this. Now parents said, okay, now it's a matter of money. I can save much more than £60, and it's much nicer, and what I saw is a big spike in the number of parents that actually went on vacation off the official vacation.
And it actually became so commoditized that some travel agents would roll it into the price. They said, hey, you buy the trip from us, we'll cover the school miss fees, we'll cover everything.
Perfect, yes. Indeed.
Yeah, I really, really love that. One of the things around incentives I was hoping we would talk about, because I know both in the for-profit sector and the nonprofit sector, this is kind of a raging debate, is an individual incentive versus a team incentive. And I really like the way you dug into that about what the possible drawbacks are of doing either.
Right. So first of all, every company that I know will emphasize cooperation and teamwork and everything, right? The CEO will tell you that's what you should do. That's the right thing. But then when it comes to incentives, too often you are compensated based on your promoted, getting bonus, whatever, raises based on your own individual success. Right, so that's one of the mixed signals that I talk about in the book. That look, as a CEO, you need to decide: you want teamwork or do you want individual success? Right. So if you pay me for individual success, why would I do, say, mentoring a new employee that comes to work? Why would I work with them? I shouldn't. I should just deal with my own stuff, right? So it's really important for the CEO to make sure that their incentives and their message are aligned. Now, in some cases, you'll say, look, teamwork is really important. We really care about that. In other cases, you can say, look, I need the best people, right? I need the stars. The stars will not come if they'll get some kind of equal pay as everyone else, right? So it's not that you should always put your incentives on the team part of it. You should think about what's really important. If you want to encourage the stars to come, give them some incentives based on that. If team work is what important, give the incentive based on that. Don't think that you can say one thing and pay a different way and nothing will happen.
And you gave some real world examples in soccer.
So the idea is, they imagine that you're about to score a goal. There are two options in front of you. One, you can try to make it yourself and say that you have 20% chance of succeeding. Or you can pass it to another player that is in better position, say that this other player has 50% chance of succeeding. Now, for the team, it's clearly better that you'll pass the ball to the other player and increase the chances that you score, right? The team doesn't really care who scores it. They want to score the goal. But your incentives might be different. Say that you're getting much more. Say that you're getting 10 times more if you score it yourself than if you just assist someone else. Then you might go for the lower chance but higher payoff, right? So again, you want to encourage them. You want to incentivize them to score goals. You want to get the best scorer to your team, and you have to pay for that. But you have to be careful that it doesn't give them weird incentives.
The last one I was hoping we would talk about and is salary negotiation. And the reason I was hoping we'd talk about that is, honestly, so often in the nonprofit sector, we're terrible at that. You know, like most of us who got into the sector did it because of a deep passion, and then they're almost embarrassed to say, oh, this is how much I think I should get paid. So I would love for us to talk some about salary negotiation.
Right. So again, that goes back to the overhead. I think that the fact that you have a passion for, my daughter is into dogs. She works in the Humane Society, and she's willing to lose a lot of money in order to work with us. That's fine, but it doesn't mean that you should volunteer all the time, right? Or that you should be paid, you should be underpaid, right? Because then at the end, you're going to lose the good people. My passion for this, and was discussed already, that say that I see that I can make $100,000 in a nonprofit, $1 million in as a bank financial advisor, I should go and work as a financial advisor and give whatever, a nice check to the charity, right? We want the people in the nonprofit sector to also earn, I think that they should earn close at least to the market wages, if not the same, right? I don't think that being embarrassed about this, having the discussion about money should not be embarrassing. If I would have been the employer, I would have, you know, at least an annual discussion with them, evaluation, and then expectations about salary, and then reality check, right? But asking for it, and that's, so I teach negotiation, and when you talk about salary negotiation, there are two things that you have to remember. First, you need to show that you're enthusiastic about the job. If you are not, why would I hire you? Your value to me depends on how enthusiastic you are about the job, right? And the second one is that you should ask. It's not bad to ask. It's part of what we do. You work hard, you need to justify why you deserve the money and negotiate.
And you talked about signals that both the employer and the prospective employee give off in that salary negotiation recruitment process.
Right. So in general, in negotiation, there are many things that you can look at the psychology of them. For example, it's not so much in salary negotiation, but in negotiation when you have, you know, when you're buying something, say you have one item, making the first offer and making it aggressive but reasonable could really help. It helps you because, first of all, you anchor the other side high enough. Second, you can work on reciprocity. If I started high enough, I can make a concession such that you will reciprocate by making your own concession. Right? So if I just say, I want $400,000 for this, and you try to negotiate and say, no, is worse than if I start at $450 and then go down to $430 and then to $410, right? So it's really, it helps with making it nicer. Another one is that price equals quality. If you say, I deserve this, it's some kind, I don't know what's your quality. If you want a bottle of wine, say, usually you buy a $20 wine. Now you're going to celebrate her birthday. So you're going to, you go to the store and say, okay, today I'm going to spend $50 on wine, right? So that's because we think that a more expensive wine is going to be better, right? And the last one is the contrast effect, right? So the other side will be happier if you started at $450 and ended up at $410 than if you started at $400 and stayed in, right? So all these good things, good psychological thing, basically said, start, make the first offer, make it aggressive, but reasonable. What's reasonable? Reasonable is such that the other side will not walk away and say, so if you go and usually they pay $20 an hour and you ask for $50 an hour, they'll just tell you, thank you and good luck, right?
And so it sounds like if the employer makes an offer, as the prospective employee, I should 100% counter.
Depends on what, right? So you can say, look, this is a great offer. I'm really excited about this. But then maybe not with salary. Then you can say, add a few other clarifications. For example, the start date. Say that you don't want to start, you want to take a break, a few weeks to travel before, or you, more vacation, or a different office, or something like that. So asking for more, again, as long as you do it in a reasonable way, you should remember that that's part of the job interview. Right, so the salary negotiation doesn't mean, you know, they tell you you have the job, but if you will be, if you'll do it in an unpleasant way, they'll say no. But if you'll do it in a pleasant way, they'll say yes. I had one of the students told me an amazing story, I think, that they keep repeating. So he finished law school, huge debt, you know, student debt, and then looking for a job for a long time. Then he got exactly the job that he wanted. He interviewed for them. Everything went well, series of interviews. And they told him, okay, you're going to make $140,000 a year. And he questioned, said, no, thank you, great. And walked home, celebrated with his friends, and they didn't call him back. After a week, he called them back. He said, look, now what happened? He said, well, part of your job is going to negotiate for clients, and you just accepted the first offer. So he decided to move on and pick up someone else, right? Negotiating is fine as long as you do it in a sensible way.
Ori, I have to share with you, I say this all the time to executive directors that are hiring a fundraiser or a development director, because so often I'll see an executive director who says, okay, I want to pay $75,000 a year, and I want to get someone who can raise millions of dollars every year. That might be through major gifts or a good annual campaign or whatever. And my response is always, it's ironic that you want someone who can ask for money for everyone but themselves. It's unlikely you're going to find that person.
Right. You want someone that is really interested in money because that's their job. They're going to raise money, but not for themselves. That's a good point, yes.
Yeah. I often end up having to say that to executive directors. And as I was hearing you talk about those mixed signals, that's actually kind of what was going through my head. Ori, I'm so glad you've come on. And I know our time is quickly coming to a close. I do want to have an opportunity toward the end of every episode. We like to do two truths and a lie. And then I get to guess which one is the lie. I'll also share with you, Ori, I'm terrible at this game. It's one of the reasons why I do it. So that way everyone can see something I'm really bad at, and hopefully I'll get better over time. So I would love it if you had two truths and a lie, and you might be willing to play.
If I'm here, I might as well play. How long should the story be?
So I know I promised you that we'd be done in about 5 minutes, but I've got a little bit of extra time. So as long as you'd like the story to be.
So there are three things that I might do, and then I want to tell you a story, a longer story, if that's okay, after you'll guess, right?
Of course.
So yeah. I enjoy smoking cigars, I enjoy surfing, and I enjoy running a marathon.
Okay. You're in San Diego, and I see surfers around San Diego often, so I do think you're a surfer, and now I have to decide about whether I think you run a marathon or you smoke cigars. Knowing that believing you're a surfer makes me think that you like physical activity. And knowing that you're an economist makes me think you're less likely to smoke cigars. So I'm going to guess that you are a surfer and you're a runner.
So I'm not a surfer. I surf, right? So don't mistake me as, if they look at the Zoom or the audience later on, they'll see that I'm not a surfer. So I do surf. I do paddleboarding. I do not run marathon, and I do smoke cigars.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Wow. I got it completely wrong.
Here's the story that I wanted to share related. So my grandma grew up in Budapest. And she used to tell me how she loved math. She was really into this. That was her thing, right? She really loved math. And after school, she used to take a bus to the other side of town to go to some tutoring in math during high school. And everything was great. And she had everything planned. She thought about going to the university. And then one day on the bus, she met the guy who turned out to be, who later on became my grandfather, right? And everything changed. So she fell in love with this guy and she decided not to go to university. And they lived happily ever after, but she still thought about it. Now, that's a complete lie. This story is a complete lie, right? There's nothing true about it. I had a grandma, that's true. Mm-hmm. That part is true, right? But other than that, nothing's true. But what she did tell me about lies is that the people I should be careful from are not the people that look suspicious. Those people, I'll find out. People that I don't trust, those I shouldn't worry about them. I will notice when they lie to me. The people I should be worried about are the people that looks really trustworthy. So that's the lesson that my grandma told me. Don't believe every story that you hear.
That is a smart, smart grandma. Oh my gosh, I love that. Well, Ori, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. And in our show notes, we are going to link to Mixed Signals so that all of our friends who are listening can buy your book or pick it up on Audible. I will share with you, friends, I both read the book and listened to it on Audible because when I love a book, that's typically what I do. It just helps me digest it in different ways. And again, Ori, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right, friends, if you found this topic engaging, if it gave you information that you are going to be using, please, there's two more I'd like for you to think about downloading and listening to. One is episode 302, Maximize Your Employee Engagement and Retention with Rob Woronoff. And the second is episode 307, Empower Your Team, Unleashing Leadership Potential with Louis Velasquez and Kristen Kleitzman. That, my friend, is our show for the week. I hope that you have gained some insight to help you and your nonprofit thrive. And the lawyers make me do it. Otherwise, I wouldn't. I'm not an accountant nor an attorney. I say it every week, and neither I nor the consulting practice provide tax, legal, or accounting advice. Please, if that is what you need, find a licensed, qualified person. Do not get that kind of advice from a podcast. Find that licensed, qualified person and get the help that you need.